use. Call 1-800-207-3483. 1-800-207-3483.
It must be, it has to be, with that big sound it's gotta be, KSVO.
Good afternoon, it's AM 1080 KSCO 206. We'll take a quick look at your traffic. Not much going on your roadways, 117-101, traveling at the limit right now. We did have a collision, 156 at Union, just before the top of the hour, and also a collision with minor injuries, 101 northbound at San Juan, on the off-ramp at 120. Your weather looks like a 60% chance of rain overnight, less than a tenth of an inch, if anything. Sunny tomorrow, we'll have a high near 66. Next 3 days, we'll have highs in the mid-70s after that. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday all should be warm and sunny. It's 2:07 at KSCO, time for Planet Watch with Rachel Goodman and Cosmic Joe Jordan. KSCO Santa Cruz.
Big solutions to Earth-sized problems. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman with my co-host Joe Jordan and intern Tommy Martin. Today on the program, great ideas from the future from the next generation. High school students Pascal Costa and Logan Conover from Merritt Academy tackle solutions to some big problems like overpopulation and CO2 emissions. We'll also talk about science notes and various phenomenon with our expert here, Joe Jordan. Stay tuned. This is Planet Watch. And here to bring you a little bit of news is we have two people, Joe Jordan and Tommy Martin, and myself. And I will start out with some interesting news from the journal Nature. Scientists, and in fact an international team of them, writing in the journal Nature, have laid out a carbon law scenario, which they say has a 75% chance of reducing, holding global warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. The authors argue that a carbon roadmap driven by a simple rule of thumb or carbon law of halving, H-A-L-V-I-N-G, emissions, halving emissions in half every decade could catalyze disruptive innovation. Some of the ways they intend to get there are to remove fossil fuel subsidies by 2020, exit coal from the scenario in 2030, and oil exiting our energy mix in this decade, the 2040s. And by doing that, we will get to carbon neutral by 2050. They are modeling the carbon law after Moore's law, something that one might be familiar to various computer scientists among us.
Hey, can you hand me the item about the Colorado victory on fracking? And this is very appropriate to today because we have youth in the studio with us for the first time, something I've been meaning to do for a while. We've got a couple of high school students and a teacher of theirs, their college advisor. We'll introduce them later. But anyway, our Children's Trust, have you heard of that? Bunch of, young people up in the Pacific Northwest have been suing the federal government about screwing up our climate, basically. Well, there's a sort of a statewide offshoot of that in Colorado, and there was a big win in a fracking lawsuit for Colorado. The Colorado Court of Appeals reversed the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's order that was denying a youth-brought rulemaking petition against fracking and a lower court's order upholding that denial. This court remanded the case to the district court and the commission, finding that the commission erred in its interpretation of Colorado's law. Now, of course, this is all still hanging fire, but one of the quotes that I especially liked from the young people about this was, from the courts, from the streets to the courtroom, the voices of the younger generation will be heard, and the legal system is a tool for our resistance. Small wins build up to create massive change. I'm very optimistic about the potential this lawsuit has to protect my Colorado. Now more than ever, we will see people reclaiming their power. Well, there's a lot more detail on all this, but stay tuned on fracking as bans on that statewide and regionally and locally continue to proliferate across the country, including right here in the Monterey Bay area.
I would like to see some of those lawsuits in Oklahoma and beyond Colorado.
Yeah, well, speaking of youth, we got Tommy here, our Cabrillo College intern. And
another story about youth, too, actually.
Okay.
Science has long sought a genetic path to slowing down the aging process. And new research led by scientists at Harvard Medical School has discovered a way to slow down DNA damage from aging and even radiation. The experiments, which were conducted on mice, look into a key regulator of protein-to-protein interactions in DNA repair. While the researchers warn mice often have vastly different effects from such treatment, if further trials on other animals do affirm the research, it could lead to therapies which prevent DNA damage from aging, cancer, treatments involving radiation, and even some types of chemotherapy. Human trials are expected to begin within the next 6 months.
Oh, sign me up.
Exciting.
Sign me up. The fountain of youth. Okay.
It's often commented that mice are different from people, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. They are mammals, though. Yeah.
Some good news on the solar front. In research published this week in Nature Energy, researchers at Kanika Corporation, a rosin and plastics manufacturer based in Osaka, described the first silicon solar cell to achieve a record-breaking 26.3% efficiency, a 0.7% increase over the previous record. This may not seem like a lot, but it's really a big step when you consider that silicon solar cells' theoretical maximum efficiency is just 29%. So they're reaching the absolute ceiling of efficiency, and all of that means that we will make more energy from fewer cells, which has got to be a good thing. Sure. I recently just flew in from Utah, and I saw these giant solar farms in the Nevada desert. And it is something to behold because they go on for miles. Most of us don't see them. Some of them are in California, some are in Nevada, some are in Utah.
No wonder there are so many jobs in solar right now.
Indeed. Someone had to put them there.
Something about efficiency, by the way, when we say a solar cell has an efficiency of 26%+, that just means the fraction of the incoming light, sunlight, that gets converted to electricity. To direct current DC electricity. For your household, that runs on AC, and you have to have a thing called an inverter that converts the DC to AC, but that's actually very efficient and you have very little loss. So anyway, we're getting up to more than a quarter of the incoming light getting converted to electricity. And you think, well, hey, that's really bad. I mean, three quarters of it gets, what, turned into heat? Yeah, but you know what? Plants, photosynthesis are the most prevalent, amazing system for converting sunlight to energy on the planet. Guess what their efficiency is? It's about 1 or 2%. So, I mean, efficiency isn't everything. Cost is certainly another factor, too, and those are coming down. So, anyway, stay tuned.
Stay tuned, indeed. So we're going to segue, I believe, unless you had one more.
Well, I had one more quick little item, which I can make short work of. There was apparently the first ever flight in the world, a charter flight to view the Aurora Australis, not the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, but this was the Southern Lights. And they left out of New Zealand this past week and flew overnight. A bunch of people paid a lot of money, and they were just awestruck by the display. From reading about it, it sounds just like what I experienced. I was studying the ozone with NASA Ames Research Center. We were based out of Norway, flew out over the North Pole. And on the way back, I was up in the cockpit chatting with the pilots. And I said, have you all seen any aurora yet? And they said, well, not yet. And then at that time, right at that moment, everybody looked over to the left, and there was what looked like a low grass fire, but it was the aurora over Finland. And then it grew up into tremendous glaciers of light on both sides of the plane. It was like we were flying through the aurora, and that's what these people experienced. Now, the aurora are actually 50 or 60 miles up, so you don't fly through them in jets. But they had a stupendous experience, and they expect to do this again in another year or so. So maybe you can. And by the way, the aurora is like a fluorescent light, but in the open atmosphere. It's the same phenomenon, basically, that's going on in a fluorescent light tube, but out in the air and space. So,
oh, thank you for that, Joe. It's an interesting phenomenon that people would fly into aurorae. We're really excited to have Susan Tatsui Darcy here in the studio with us today with two of her students. Susan runs Merritt Academy in Santa Cruz, California, and Merritt is known for challenging its students to do really enterprising projects. And as we heard earlier, that there's more and more youth getting involved with trying to solve these huge issues in our culture, in our world, especially having to do with scientific solutions to some of the problems. Maybe science is even caused by discovering things like fossil fuel burning. So we're going to talk to your two students, but I thought we would begin with you, if we could move your mic over or move you to it.
And while you're doing that, we got to mention the email address.
Thank you. It's radioplanetwatch@gmail.com if you have questions for our guests. So we would love to include your questions in our conversation. And the advice I have is get them in early so we can read them aloud and send them to our guests here. So, Susan, tell me about how these projects for your students originate. Do they come up with the ideas? And what's the prompt that starts them off?
Okay, yes. The students all come up with their own ideas. We try to find their passion. So for some students, like Logan, within the first one or two sessions of meeting with him, he came up with his project idea, When Not If. And Pascal, on the other hand, had about a million ideas. She wanted to save the world, and she was looking at animal farming and all kind of just climate change. She was looking at so many different ideas. And every week I'd say, okay, Pascal, we really need to focus in on your project so you can actually accomplish that during your time here. And she'd come in with a new idea each week, but then she came up with the latest, which is now climate, which is the population control, preventing overpopulation. So she worked on that. That's her project. So the kids do work on their own ideas.
And how many years do they have? Just 1 or 9 months? What's the duration of the project?
Well, most students start their project in 9th or 10th grade, so I usually have them for 2 or 3 years. And the students have the opportunity to do something in as little as 3 or 4 months if they want to do a quick project like an event. But a lot of students, like these two, did or created organizations. And they went out and found a problem, and they went and created an organization so that it would continue to go through college. And there are 4 million kids that enter 9th grade every year. And I wrote the book called Beat the College Admissions Game, Do a Project. And I'm thinking that if 4 million kids start a project every year, we can actually solve a lot of the problems that we're looking at today, because they can have 4 years in high school to complete it and then continue in college to perfect it. And we would be able to accomplish more in those 4 years with those 4 million kids than politicians and corporations combined.
Well, certainly when we hear these lawsuits of youth saying, hey, you're robbing us of our future unless you solve these things, that's getting at the heart of what we're talking about. So, Pascal, if I can get you to move close to the mic there, tell me about why you picked this one and tell us about your project.
As Susan said, I had a lot of different interests. I researched factory farming and climate change and GMOs, and what I found was that the root cause of these issues was overpopulation, and I decided that I really wanted to hit all these problems, two birds with one stone in a way, and so that's why I decided to target overpopulation and start this organization.
And tell me more about overpopulation. It's been kind of falling off the front page lately, and some people say, oh, it's controversial because you're telling people whether or not to reproduce. Tell us more about why you think this is the big problem. If you solved that one, why would the other ones follow?
The biggest issue that we face in terms of overpopulation is the fact that we have 35 years until we reach Earth's maximum capacity. Right now, we are at 7.5 billion people, and in 35 years, we're supposed to hit 10 billion. And by that point, Earth will no longer be able to sustain us, and we will have to fight over resources. And it's really, our quality of life will significantly decrease. And that's why overpopulation is such a huge issue. And the whole goal of POP, or Preventing Overpopulation, the organization that I started a year ago, is to educate people so that they aren't forced into the option of having two kids, but instead they understand the issue, they understand how much power they have in that situation in terms of how two children or four children can completely affect our environment and our future.
What are some of the math problems you crunched around this 7 billion number and the future wind down? Because you can't ramp it down too fast, or there'll be no young people to work, you know, anymore. Yeah. And we won't have any food. So it's a really tricky thing how to get there. Have you messed with some of the numbers?
Yeah, basically, if everybody in the world had two kids, we could decrease our global population by 1.6 billion in the next decade. So while there, an example actually of the issue of elder care and all of that is China and their one-child policy, and how now they face the 4-2-1 problem, where they have four elders, two parents, and one child to care for those six relatives. And basically, if everybody had two kids, the job of taking care of four elders and two parents would be split between two children. And in addition to that, with the way healthcare and medicine is excelling, the lifespan would still remain long, so the parents would be able to care for the elders for some period of time, and there wouldn't be as much of an problem with these kids taking care of their grandparents and their parents. So really, this two-child policy, this voluntary two-child policy through education, I think is a great solution, because people get educated, people become aware so that they want to be a part of this, but it also deletes this problem of elder care. And yeah.
So for the equation about women's reproductive, you know, choice, education is one way, and funding Planned Parenthood type programs around the world is another. Have you looked into expenditures for family planning and education in your mix of how we're going to get there?
Yeah. So in terms of the finances, or that aspect of family planning, having two kids actually costs $820,000, which is a lot of money. And if you even add that to elder care, caring for two parents, that's a total of about $2 million to $4 million. And that really adds up. So in terms of the cost and the financial aspect of this, there actually is a lot of financial motive for families to have two kids or less than two kids, because a lot of them can't really afford more than that. So
part of it's, you know, your ability to get out of poverty. The other part, which we talk about a lot here on Planet Watch, is just the exponential impact on the environment, which you mentioned earlier. Wouldn't it be more imperative on countries like ours who are already over-consuming to limit more than some countries where, you know, the average person only consumes a fraction of what developed country people do? And that's going to meet some headwinds if you suggest it, but it seems makes sense to me.
It's definitely crucial for a lot of people think that countries like India and underdeveloped countries are really important because the birth rate is so high, but it's actually really crucial for developed countries to keep their birth rate low because of how much each person consumes.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
We're talking with Pascal Costa. She's a student at Merit Academy working on a population education program that's going to bring down the birth rate in our nation and all around the world, so that we don't run out of planet in 35 years, which is a real problem already showing up. They say we would need many Earths if China developed to the extent of the United States. I don't remember how many, but it was more than we have, because right now we have one, as far as I know.
I want to give that email address again for people to interact with us. Radio Planet Watch at gmail.com. So send us your comments. You know, this whole overpopulation thing raises a lot of ire, a lot of emotions among people, even among folks who I know and respect, and I can't quite get at what it is. I mean, you know, I don't know, telling people how they need to behave or misbehave or not misbehave in the bedroom or something. You know, here's an easy one. If you have overpopulation, then there's poverty. Everybody gets that. But what about the other connection, that poverty causes overpopulation? That's something that a lot of people, most people, don't know. You never hear that. But it's true for reasons I'm sure you folks are hip to. But, you know, poverty, attacking poverty, there's something we can work on. You know, we can say we're doing that, and at the same time, we're attacking overpopulation. So what do you think of that, or what's your...
I definitely think that poverty, in a way, leads to overpopulation. There's definitely a connection between women who don't receive an education and them having more kids. But I think that the way to face that, or at least another way to look at it, is that, for example, in the United States, a lot of people say that families in poverty are the bigger families, that those are the families with more kids. But in fact, if that, because so much of the lower class makes up a huge part of the population in America, that would mean that our birth rate would be higher. But in fact, even though that may be true, our birth rate is still 2.06. I do think that a solution to that is to still just to create widespread education, to just make everybody aware of the financial aspects of overpopulation or of family planning and the environmental aspects of family planning, because that's the best way to make sure that people plan in a way that won't put them in a position where they are no longer able to afford their own life or afford to take care of others.
One of the clarification on something you were saying about encouraging people to have two kids. You mean at most two kids, right? You know, this actually, there's a throwback to the 60s when I first saw Paul Ehrlich, who's famous. He wrote the book, The Population Bomb. And he came to Oberlin College where I was a student and gave a assembly to the entire college. And it was just electrifying. Anyway, though, about that time, ZPG, zero population growth, sprang up. And people would all wear buttons that say, stop at two. Stop at two. Do you remember those days? Maybe that was before anybody else in here was born. But back in the 60s, that was a thing. And so I guess that's kind of what you're saying there, right? I mean, you're not saying have two kids. You're saying at most two kids.
Well, at less than two.
Yeah, the whole thing about POP is that people still have choice in this process. They still can choose not to have kids, to have two kids. They can still have more. The whole idea is to educate them and educate that choice, that process of family planning, not to force them into it. So I am, in a way, advising that people have two kids because of the environmental and financial effects that it will have. But there still is choice in that process. We're not trying to take it away in any way. So
I would say another important choice to talk about would probably be adoption, which I'm a big fan of. I think that's a really important thing to talk about when it comes to overpopulation.
Yeah, definitely. People can always adopt.
Yeah. And your website, you have a little whiteboard video on there.
Yeah.
The website is popoverpop.com. I know popovers are pastry things, but anyway, what is pop over pop? Well, over pop, I can see that, overpopulation, but what's the pop over pop?
That definitely, when I was coming up with the website names, I thought of popping overpopulation's bubble. It was kind of a weird thought process, so I thought pop over pop.
.com, right?
Or yes, actually, it would be awesome if people could go to that page and watch the video because it provides a lot of extra information. But there's also a page where you can actually pledge to have two or less kids, and it actually will let me know if people are hearing this or if they're getting the message or if they even support the organization. So.
Mm-hmm. It's great to see people working on this issue because, as Joe said, it kind of fell off the radar. There was a big fight in the Sierra Club. You know, can we talk about overpopulation as an environmental issue? And I think they just decided to stash it away somewhere because it was too controversial, especially since some people wanted to talk about immigration in that same conversation, and that's where it fell apart. But immigration is not the same thing unless you worry about countries' boundaries, which many people do. The displacement of large sectors of various populations does have to do with resource depletion, and you can say that's due to overpopulation in some places as well. It's just a difficult construct for a lot of people to get their heads around, and I'm not saying I agree, but I've noticed it just really fell off the radar. So I commend you for bringing it back up.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here to talk about this important issue. And I want to get back to your project again, but I thought we'd bring in Logan, who's got a related issue. to talk to us about his project, which is really about car emissions, as I understand it, and trying to get people to do another difficult thing. I mean, it's somewhat hard to limit your family numbers, but not so much if you have birth control and education. It seems for some people really hard, at least conceptually at first, to stop driving as much. So let's talk about the psychology of that one and what your project is all about.
Yeah, well, my project is about getting people to reduce driving and giving people information that can maybe influence their decision with the carbon CO2 emissions and the problems that it can create in the atmosphere and the positive feedback loop surrounded with it. And so with more CO2 in the atmosphere, the heat gets trapped on Earth and it melts the ice in the North and South Poles. And the ice that is there actually reflects the sunlight back into the atmosphere and or into space. And so it doesn't continue to get warmer, but then the ocean actually absorbs the heat, warming the planet even more. And right now, in the atmosphere, I'm pretty sure that the CO2 is around 400 parts per million. And a safe level that most scientists agree upon is like around 350 parts per million. So we're way over that. And if it continues to rise at the levels that it has since the Industrial Revolution, it will throw us into that loop and it'll continue getting warmer and warmer on Earth until it's too warm for us to be there.
Do you, I always wonder if people in high school and in their 20s get angry when they look at that story and they didn't really have any, as much impact on bringing us to this point, or do you get motivated? What's your emotional reaction to looking at things as they stand? And obviously one of them is to get involved and do a project, but what's going through your mind when you're learning about where we're at?
Well, for the most part, it's kind of a little bit scary thinking of all these problems that can happen in my lifetime and definitely in like the next couple generations. But for the most part, the people who I've been talking to, like students in my classes, they don't really seem to have like the same motivation that I do. And so like you were talking about like the college students earlier, and they seem a lot more motivated to prevent like these natural disasters and stuff than high school students. So I think like part of it might be like growing up and that it's not that big of an issue for high school students because they're so caught up in what's happening to them. They don't see like the big picture.
And do you think it's taught enough in high school so that maybe if they did know more about it, they'd get more involved earlier?
I definitely in my classes haven't like heard anything about it really, about CO2, other than there's been a couple students who like talk about it and like if like there's a class poll or something, like most people will say it's like an issue for them, but they're not really doing anything about it. And so I think that's the great thing about When Not If and what I'm doing.
So tell us about When Not If and what its goals are and why you picked that.
So our main goal is basically to prevent the positive feedback loop from happening and having too much CO2 in the atmosphere. It's been like an increasing problem, as I said, since like the Industrial Revolution. And so cars, for every gallon of gas that's used, emits about 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. And
that's a quiz question, folks.
We'll be checking later.
Every gallon of gasoline, you emit about 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. That's worth knowing.
And so for most people, they don't drive that far. And so like even reducing 5%, it's only like a mile of driving less if you drive 20 miles per week or something. So it's really easy for people to do. And that's really good, I think.
Yeah, it seems like it's like that meatless Monday. If you're trying to get people to reduce meat, then you pick a day and then you've 1/7 of your meat consumption, assuming you're eating it daily. But that's one kind of easy way to remember. What are some educational things that are part of your project that might make it easy and attractive? Because that always seems to be the threshold. People don't like to do things that are super inconvenient where they have to walk 25 miles to work. So,
Well, some of the things that like my project goes upon. I send monthly email reminders to people saying, remember to, like, drive that far much less, or however much you pledge to reduce. And I give, like, a helpful hint or something. Or not, like, a hint, but, like, give a suggestion of something that you can do.
What's an example of a suggestion you might give somebody?
Well, I mean, there's always, like, the carpooling or biking or something. But if you can't do that and you work far away, you can put, like, a bike in your car. And if you work in a city like San Francisco or something, when you get there, you can bike a couple miles. Or, and then you're reducing your driving.
And you might have less parking tickets.
The driving is a pretty tough one for Californians because we do so much commuting here. The Meatless Monday might be a little more accessible, but...
And the Driveless Monday?
Yeah, but I also see that it could make a big impact here because we do so much driving.
You know, what about public transit? I don't know if you've dealt with that, but that's something we really have to deal with in this country. I mean, Europe, you go over there and you can set your watch by the buses and the trains, but here... most places in the U.S., we just haven't caught on yet. You know, is that necessary? can we do something about that? Do you address that, or do you want to address that? I would submit that would be one way of getting people out of their cars and trucks.
Yeah, at some of the events that I've been to, like last year at Earth Day Santa Cruz, they cut, like, some of the bus routes, and they weren't going as often. And so a lot of people were saying that, like, that's something that we really need to look at, and to have a better public transportation system in order to get people to reduce driving, because here there's buses and they're fairly accessible, but sometimes the buses don't run as often as it's convenient for people, so it's easier to drive.
Certainly a factor, and it's always that catch-22. Enough riders mean that there's more money for transit, so investing it in the beginning is a good idea, and then making sure the routes are there is another good thing. So if you just joined us, we are Planet Watch. We're talking to some youngsters, high school students from Merritt Academy. You don't often hear high school students on the radio talking about important issues like this. It's great to have you, and I really appreciate the time you've put into these projects. One question I have, of course, maybe for both of you, is it takes a lot to reach a lot of people with these messages. Your messages are very positive, and they seem like things people can do something about. It's always a trick of marketing, right? Getting your word out. So how do you work on that piece of it? And I'll have Logan and then Pascal can lean into the mic.
Well, I was in the newspaper last year, and so that was helpful, and I've been going to Earth Day Santa Cruz, and then I went to another event down in Sand City. But, like, the major thing that I'm working on right now is trying to reach people through social media and my friends and my friends' friends, and just have it, like, start with, like, something small and then reach more people over time.
Seems like a very powerful tool. If you look at what just happened with the healthcare bill being pulled, there was a firestorm through social media, and people called and called and wrote and showed up, and it's an instantaneous thing. You used to have to buy mailers back in our old days. You know, you used to have to get stamps and lick them. How horrible.
I liked those stamps.
Oh, you like the flavor?
Yeah.
Have at it, Joe. So there's that instantaneous thing, but there is a downside in that there's so many people using social media to get these words out about various things. It can be completely overwhelming for the recipient to get 20,000 different causes contacting you and saying, it's an emergency, do it now. And they're right. But yeah, the recipient can kind of get deer in the headlights problem. So how do you stand out without overwhelming people? Is there an optimal practice?
Well, the main thing I get, because I ask people when I ask them to pledge to reduce their driving, is to give their email so I can send them a reminder and give them a suggestion. And so I think a lot of the feedback I've gotten is, like, don't spam me with emails every day. And so I think there's, like, a balance between them, because I've signed up for other organizations also to help support them, and they just, every day, constant. So I think that's something that definitely needs to... There's, like, a fine line between too much and not enough.
And often it's your friends talking to you that make the most difference. So word of mouth, if your friend wants to carpool, you've just solved one of your people, right?
Yeah.
Pascal, how about you? You have an international goal.
Right now, I'm trying to get better about the social media aspect of getting the word out, but mainly what I want to do, what I'm trying to do right now, is put together kits that I can go to public middle schools or public high schools and go into classes and talk to the kids and teach them, so to speak, about the environmental effects of overpopulation, why it's so important to plan their families and the financial aspects of families, because a lot of these kids in high school, middle school are starting to maybe not think, but are being faced with the aspect of kids and families. And I think that's the age group that's most important in terms of bringing awareness of this issue.
Sometimes they face the issue before they're ready to face the issue, so to speak. That's why we all ought to support Planned Parenthood, who gives birth control for free, and education as well about avoiding unwanted pregnancies, because that can be the way people get introduced unwittingly to parenthood. It's better to choose it than to have it choose you. So that seems to be a great ally as well. Planned Parenthood is doing that same work on a giant scale.
Hey, do we have a couple minutes to talk a little bit about something Susan's been involved with for years, which relates to Logan's topic of, you know, driving and what comes out the tailpipe, your car? I'll just introduce it real quickly, and then Susan can talk about her getting involved. Back in 1999 or 98, I was over at Susan and her husband Rob's place and told him about hydrogen. And that, hey, here's a fuel for cars, which, you know, the exhaust is pure water. And you can make electricity and heat and water. And it's what the space station and the space shuttle astronauts use as their onboard power station, is a thing called a fuel cell. Quiet, clean, electrochemical, no noise, pollution, or moving parts. So Susan went and got a, I don't know, $30,000 grant from the Department of Energy, got her kids, then kids, now grown and through college and grad school and everything, going on a national project to make a hydrogen fuel cell powered ice cream maker, which they took to meetings all over the country. She started this organization called Kids for Hydrogen. I guess it's at k4h.org. Well, anyway, Susan, take it away. You can fill in the rest of the story there.
Yes, I did meet with Joe. We had lunch one day. And as a matter of fact, Rachel, you invited us to speak on one of your radio shows back then. It was wonderful. So the Mary Academy kids were in eighth grade, and they were the first kids in the world to build a hydrogen fuel cell. So they received a lot of attention. We received a $30,000 or $40,000 grant from the Department of Energy, and we built it, and then we went on tour across the United States to educate people about what fuel cells were. And, you know, nobody knew what a hydrogen fuel cell was back in 1998, so we went to the caucus, and we went all over D.C. to explain to Congress people what the potential of hydrogen fuel cells were. The problem back then was that they didn't have a vehicle ready to go. We didn't have the technology in place so people can embrace it. And this was frustrating for our students. That was my oldest daughter, Nicole, who was part of that process of building that fuel cell. 4 years later, my younger daughter started Kids for Hydrogen, and she started that in 2004. But back then, again, the technology wasn't in place. People could not go out and buy a hydrogen fuel cell car and drive it at that point. So it was really difficult to get people to embrace a concept that was just so far out in the future. But today, we actually have solutions. Every automaker has a hydrogen fuel cell car that you can lease. If you live in Los Angeles or in California, you could pretty much have access to hydrogen fueling stations and be able to lease a car. You can also purchase the Mirai. It's the Toyota Mirai. And that's the hydrogen fuel cell world. The problem with that, I'll say this quickly, is we have 1 billion cars on the earth, internal combustion engine cars that are spewing CO2, just like what Logan's trying to stop. We can't get 1 billion people to start buying hydrogen fuel cell cars right now and fix the problem so that we don't face the positive feedback loop that we're facing. So, although this is a very controversial subject, and even Joe and I have kind of gone around and around about this, there's a fellow, his name is Dr. McAllister, Roy McAllister, and he's down in Arizona. He's part of Arizona State University. He created Metrol out of anything that rots, and it produces a liquid hydrogen that's a flex fuel that can be used as gasoline or as a flex fuel in any internal combustion engine. You'd have to convert your car. It's as simple as like a tune-up. You just put in it's called a smart plug instead of a spark plug. And the technology's in place. And if this is all going to work, it's a big if, and that's what all the scientists are all kind of, you know, we want to see real examples. It can actually solve our problem because we can actually go into this immediately and beat the problem to be able to get the CO2 completely out of the atmosphere, because all the internal combustion engine cars will run on hydrogen, which is a pure, clean fuel where there's no zero emissions. It actually takes, he claims that it takes CO2 out of the atmosphere because of the photosynthesis process.
It's great to hear about your project. And one thing I can say about hearing from all these different scientists about many, many solutions, it's we need them all, and we need them now or soon, between now and 2040, when oil, as the scientists at the beginning of the show were telling us, needs to exit. By 2040, and that's not very far into the future.
Let a thousand flowers bloom. I was thinking that might be a title for this show. So let a thousand flowers bloom.
Thousand hybrids and electric cars and hydrogen cars go.
And we will talk more about hydrogen later. It is somewhat controversial just because, how do you get hydrogen? It's not lying around in nature. You have to devote some energy to getting it. But do we have a question here from somebody?
Yeah, we do.
Do we have time here? This is kind of.
We probably have time for one question, and then
this is
wrap it.
Kersha, thank you for speaking up about this. We who live on coastal California are already experiencing the negative effects of overpopulation, such as heavy traffic, jobs, and housing competition, not having enough resources like water, loss of agriculture and open space to development. Okay, well, let's see here. I'm wondering if there is a question. Is that the end of it there? Or scroll down for me there. Let's see here. Looking for the question.
It's okay if you want to give us a positive comment. Thanks for talking about overpopulation.
Okay, here comes the question. Since I'm skipping the middle paragraph. Since Americans use most of the world's resources and energy, how do we encourage Americans to celebrate families to have one child or who are child-free? Many families are having three or four kids. So how do we help people understand that the biggest environmental solution is to have less people on the planet, which has the biggest impact on the climate crisis, too?
So it's really about how do we get the word out to people in highly consuming countries and maybe meet them halfway with bringing down their consumption. Do you really need that third or fourth car? Do you really need, you know, that purse from Louis Vuitton? Maybe, but maybe not.
One of the points I have heard is that people who intend to have two or less kids, okay, they're going for two, and oops, it was twins, and now they got three. So you might want to kind of aim for even lower than two. But anyway, thanks, Kersha. Thanks for your comments and questions. And I'm going to relay them later to our guests who haven't seen them yet, but I will send this to you. So there's more to it.
And I just want to thank you all. It's really exciting and encouraging to see the next generation stepping up in such a big way so early. And we'll look for big things from you in the future as you hone your ideas and continue them through college. So maybe you'll check back in with us in 3 or 4 years if we're all still doing this, and you are too. Love to hear what your results were after a while.
Or progress, anyway.
Exactly. It's all on a continuum, right? Yeah. So we want to thank Pascal and Logan for being here, and Susan Tatsui-Darcy, all from Merit Academy, for joining us here on Planet Watch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, great having you. And, you know, here's the point of the show where we sort of launch into other stuff and, you know, things in the sky and all that. And and little math riddles. And okay, I got a little math riddle inspired by, we've set a record here today. We got six people in the studio, right? Six people in the studio. And okay, supposing we all drank something like this nice tea that Susan brought for us, glasses of tea or, I don't know, beer or champagne or whatever, and we decide to all click, you know, have a toast where everybody clicks everybody else. Well, how many clicks would you hear? We take the headphones off, we do this. How many clicks will you hear? Now, I'm going to leave this for next time, okay? But I want listeners to think about this, too. You got six people, each clicking all of the other people. How many clicks are you going to hear? So, anyway, we'll talk about it after the show here privately. But, okay, well, now, this is our first show of the spring season. I mean, the last show was March 19th, and it wasn't quite yet spring. It was, you know, maybe 9 or 10 or 12 hours or something from the spring equinox. But we're in the spring season now, right at the equinox time. But even now, you know, a week or so later, there's an interesting observation you can make in the sky that you probably didn't know about. The sun really only rises in the east and sets in the west on 2 days of the year, the equinoxes. And that's true everywhere on the planet. The sun rises due east and sets due west on just the equinoxes. And, you know, so now, okay, it's a little after a week after the, a little over a week after the equinox, but it's still pretty close. If you go out and look at where the sun comes up and where the sun goes down, you'll know that that's pretty close to east and west. On all the other days of the year, the sun rises by varying degrees north or south of east and sets north or south of west, depending on your latitude. It depends on your latitude how far north or south of east and west the sun rises and sets. But on the equinoxes, it's the same everywhere on the earth. It comes up due east and goes down due west. And, this is actually also the time of year when the aurora, we had a news item about the aurora. I just realized here's an announcement for you to go out and look at the sky this week, wherever you are in the United States, but especially in the northern tier or on the world. The aurora is most common, for some reason that isn't really very well understood, around the equinoxes. And I'm thinking, well, maybe that's because every place on Earth has 12 hours of light and 12 hours of darkness, and so you have a good amount of darkness everywhere. But actually, there is something special going on right now. There is a big coronal mass ejection. A bunch of solar wind is blowing out from the sun, from a hole in the sun's corona or atmosphere, aimed right at the Earth. And they're expecting that come about day after tomorrow, March 28th. Observers, especially in the northern states, but you never know. We might see them here. I've seen auroras in Virginia, Ohio, and I also saw them in Tasmania off Australia. That was the Aurora Australis. But and I've seen them here in California, and not for a while, kind of like an earthquake. I'm kind of waiting for the next earthquake. But anyway, the next aurora. And So keep an eye out next few evenings. If it's clear, you might see the northern lights. And again, the northern lights, the aurora is like the same process in a fluorescent light, but in the open atmosphere.
And you don't even have to take a plane to see it. So here's a quick population puzzler quiz. You don't have to know the answer. What percentage of the world's population lives in the southern hemisphere? Wild guess, anyone?
Like right now, you mean?
Well, yeah.
What percentage? Don't listen to me. You guys say something. I'm going to think.
Take a guess. It's okay to guess, and it's okay to be wrong.
So Rachel did some homework. She knew we were talking about population. She looked up a good question.
Do you have the northern, too?
No. Oh. Well, it's going to be the opposite. I mean, where else would all those people go, right?
Well, I was wondering if you could tell me the northern so that I might have it.
Well, that would give it away.
Well, you know what? We can sort of think about this. I mean, China is completely in the northern hemisphere, right? And so is India. The equator passes south of India. Yeah, so
think of a really populous country in the southern hemisphere. Really populous.
There's a whole lot of ocean down there where nobody lives.
a lot of penguins. And so I'd
say 10%.
You peaked. That is totally exactly
is
right.
Is that exactly it?
Oh, right on the money. Well, I wish I had some money to give you.
No way.
Yes, 10%.
I was actually realizing it. I thought it was really low when I said it.
That's way lower than I would have expected.
Me too. So that just look at a globe and then look at the countries. That's what Wise Geek says, which is, you know, supposedly a very scientifically researched website. I recommend it because there's a lot of academic articles there to be found about almost everything. WiseGeek.com. Check it out. Yeah, and the other interesting population quizzy thing I thought was interesting on there was what living thing, crawly, creepy crawly living thing, equals at various times the mass of human beings on the earth. And I'll give you a hint. They're smaller than us by a lot.
Oh, no.
You're saying
what other creature can equal our mass or weight on the earth?
You mean collectively of its population?
Yes, its entire, in their entirety.
Well, if you say creepy crawly thing, I think of something that starts with a W. But
that would be incorrect for 2 points.
Well, I didn't say the whole thing.
No, but these don't start with a W.
I'm thinking ants, but I've heard it is ants.
Yes, it's ants. Wow, okay. So imagine that, how many ants that is, because humans are pretty heavy.
Wow. Well, actually, along those lines, okay, I got one for you. this is an amazing fact. As far as we know, it's a fact or close enough for government work. Half of the world's biomass, you know, biomass, living stuff, is in the first kilometer or so of the Earth's surface. I mean, I'm not counting the oceans. I mean, like the soil. Well,
are you including bacteria?
Yeah, yeah. They live in rocks. There are these things that live in rocks a mile down, and they make up half of the Earth's biomass. So that's pretty interesting.
And bacteria make up a lot of our biomass. Apparently, there's more of them in weight than there are of us. If you took away all of our internal bacteria, we would be a hollow shell. And in fact, they're probably running a lot more of us than we like to think. And we're just a vessel for them. We're keeping them happy by what we eat.
Be nice to them.
Yes, probiotic all the way. And that means we'll stay alive. Antibiotics, they don't like because we wipe out large colonies of them, and then apparently less diverse colonies take their place, and that makes us ill again. Yeah. That's a whole field of science that we have yet to understand and probably matters a lot more to our future health and living.
Yeah. More terrifying stuff to discover.
More to learn, to be afraid of, yeah. Be very afraid. We have just a minute or two in closing, so we'll talk about some future shows that are coming up and ideas that we have and give out our email again. You can also check out our archives at zbsradio.com. You can hear our audio. Look us up under Planet Watch. We have a little square with a microphone, and you can find our archive shows of all the past programs there.
Also on Facebook. You can see our videos.
Which I understand today is going back to the old days of silent movies. So you'll have to listen to the ZBS one alongside looking at us. And maybe you'll sync them up and our mouths will match what we're actually saying. ZBSradio.com. And also on Facebook, you can look up Planet Watch Radio, right?
Director Window.
All right. Joe, what do we got coming up in the next couple of weeks? I know we have 1 minute left to tell them. So how about some teasers for what they can expect?
Well, nothing is actually nailed down yet, but we have a whole bunch of, we got a marine biologist who studies the South Pacific and how the islanders down there have managed their fisheries that extend for thousands of square miles. We have the climate action coordinator for the city of Santa Cruz, as well as the former one who is now going off on his own with academic pursuits, studying sea level rise and some really interesting information there. And we've got a couple of NASA scientist friends of mine who will talk on everything from Mars to Jupiter, which, by the way, you can see Jupiter coming up in the evening now. You go out and you look east, kind of southeast, really bright, fat, white dot, that's Jupiter. And it's next to a bright blue star, not as bright as Jupiter, but the star is Spica in the constellation Virgo. And lots of interesting things on tap. And eventually some more kids.
Yay, kids. So, you are our future, after all. Well, you've been listening to Planet Watch, and we really appreciate you coming along for the ride on the planet, and we will be back again next week. Thank you so much for listening. I am your host, Rachel Ann Goodman.
This is Joe. Keep an eye on the sky, and goodbye, everybody.